My name's Paul English. I come from Leeds in Yorkshire, now residing in the south of England. And I moved to London in 1984, worked in marketing for about 6 or 7 years there. Lots of fun in a very interesting company. Went freelance as a copywriter in the early 90s and then bumped into a series of people at a place called ASLIB, the Association of Librarians, which was as exciting as it sounded. And the reason I was there was because they had an ISDN line, which was like gold dust in the early days of the internet. And they had a big network there. And that's when I first kind of got on the net and started looking at Usenet and news groups and all these other things. And this would be 1992, 93. So 30 years ago. Good grief. At that place of an evening, there were extracurricular meetings. And one night, a gentleman turned up who I didn't know, but somebody introduced me to him. He's very softly spoken. And he handed me a newsletter that he was printing on a laser printer at the time and distributing amongst a circle of his own colleagues. As I got to know him and read his newsletters, the story became sort of clearer. He'd returned from the Middle East, where he'd been training the Royal Saudi Air Force, and he was an engineer, but he was also a banker, or he was involved in a really arcane aspect of banking, which is the buying and selling of government debt. I knew nothing about these things, but he was back in England because he was very cross with the British government for all sorts of reasons, and was very cross with the banking industry. And of course, this transmitted to me, particularly when I started reading the information that he was putting down in these newsletters. So I sat with this guy for a couple of years. And by the time we got to 1996, the middle of the 90s, I realized that what I thought the world operated on was completely untrue, and that I just took the view that there was very little point participating in the economy because it's completely rigged. And I understood why it was rigged. And I had certain pieces of information presented to me at that time, well before they sort of even came on the internet. So I was kind of up to speed with things about bank trading, about this coterie of people that move vast quantities of money around controlled countries, about the issuing of birth certificates. In fact, we once drove past a government building. This would be about 1997. And he said to me, "Do you know what that building is?" I said, "No." He said, "It's a government building," because it was particularly dismal architecturally, as they usually are. And he said, "They collect all the birth certificates in there." I said, "Oh," not knowing anything about this at the time. And he said, "Then those birth certificates go up to the Treasury." "Yes." "And they do a calculation on the amount of income tax they think that baby is likely to pay over its life. And then they borrow that money at interest from the central banking mob. And they use the life of the baby as surety for the loan." And I went, "I don't like that." And he went, "I don't like that either." So there were a lot of conversations like that. And that's a long time ago, I guess, now nearly 30 years back.
Yeah, could you give us just an idea of what was in these newsletters and the name of the newsletter, the name of the person, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure. He's dead now. He went under the name of Raymond Patrick Ibrahim Grant. He was an Englishman. Well, there's a reason why he took on the name Ibrahim, because he spent a lot of time in the Middle East and he was studying Sufism and Islam and all sorts of other things. So he was a well-read individual, very softly spoken, probably, I think, in retrospect, sociopathic, if not psychopathic, but sociopathic would be the way. Highly manipulative, which I was completely unaware of at the time. Kept his notes in our meeting in his own form of Arabic shorthand. He was the only person in the world that could read it. He was slightly dyslexic. The script on the notepads was just beautiful to look at. And I asked him one day, "What is that?" He said, "Oh, that's my own language. He said, "I don't need to run any security because I'm the only person that can read it." The newsletters that he did went round to a group of about 12 or 16 people here in England that he had known before he went out to the Middle East. And they were all people from the military, because he came from a military family. And there were other people that are involved in banking or aspects of banking and what he did. And they covered more than just the banking. They covered the history of these islands, for example. I remember one being effectively a haven for criminality for hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, being protected by the water. And he said, you know, there's all these sorts of nests of criminality within London, particularly, of course, as you're well aware, I guess. And it's been like that for a long time. There was one also on the manipulation of pop music, which is the first time I'd come across this as well. This is probably before many of these things came around on the internet, but the use of certain lyrics, the way of actually, you know, hiving the family down, the creation of the teenager, because they didn't used to exist, teenagers, in the 30s, mid 40s. They only created them after World War II. topics which really I'd never come across before. I didn't even know you could even think about these things. It was that refreshing in a way. And many
you're
other
talking
aspects.
Talking about those islands, sorry to interrupt you, but you're talking about the islands. Which are we talking about? Caribbean islands, tax havens, British Virgin Islands, this sort of thing?
No, we're really just talking about London at this stage. I don't remember really talking to him much about tax havens and that, although he would have been assisting certain clients with that.
But in a way, the city of London is a sort of island in its own, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it was the city of London that all his ire was directed at, and mine too, and everybody else's should be as well, because it's a parasite right in the center of this nation, and it controls it, in simple terms. Through extremely subtle and well-developed techniques of communication, clubs, organizations, you know, the whole lot. You're probably familiar with many of them. I know you are, Tony. So the main purse strings are always, you know, controlled and pulled from there. So he knew characters in there. And he was also very skilled in law. And I ended up working with him on something that brought us to the attention of the Bank of England. I was incredibly naive at the time. I can't begin to tell you how naive I was. Looking back on it, I almost shudder, because you get to your sort of early 30s, you actually think you know things. And I was on a journey of discovering I absolutely knew nothing. He was trying to actually get himself on some very serious charges up against the UK government. And the reason was he had a lot of information. So he told me. I didn't see this, but I didn't really have a reason to doubt him, because he worked flat out on this for the 5 years that I knew him every day. And he had a lot of information on government corruption going all the way back to World War II. He was still had a bee in his bonnet about that, because his family had lost a lot of members during that conflict, and they'd lost land which had been seized by the government here, which he wanted back, which they wouldn't return. So he had an anger in him, but he was very, very softly spoken. When it came to sort of willpower, though, I've never met anybody who thought or operated like that. It was quite a very intense experience when his mind locked down on a thing. He'd taken a vow of poverty, and yet he was making money, vast sums of money, for huge multinational corporations. He explained to me, for example, and I suspect this is probably similar or still pretty true, the major, I won't put the brand name in, but major motor car manufacturers, they still exist to this day, and they've been around a long time, so I'm sure you can think of them. Here in the UK, they make more money, or at the time with him, they made more money from trading government treasury bills than they did from making cars. And in fact, so this role of people buying and selling T-bonds, T-bills, in a pre-market, which nobody knows about, very few people know about this. There's a pre-market discount before these papers come to market. They make their money from that. And I looked at the whole thing, and it was bedazzling and mad and strange and full of odd people doing odd, very odd things.
So how did this alter the way you looked at life?
Well, I thought, what's the point of me trying to build a business and be jolly old nice if it's all ultimately set up to keep us controlled? And so on a personal level, I don't like that. I just, it's my nature to not like that. I think it's healthy to not be like that. And I wanted to know, I guess, the next step was, how did the world really work? So we ended up in a court case anyway with the Bank of England, which I won't go into. It didn't turn out too good. But that opened my eyes up even further. He was incredibly cavalier about it, because he was familiar with being in courts and I wasn't. So I learned more. And then I really lost contact with him probably around about 2002. He went off to Europe somewhere, and the last report I had of him, I think he was found dead in a car in Spain, or either that, or he faked his own death, and I wouldn't put that beyond him either.
But look, you just said there you were in a court case with the Bank of England, which you won't go into.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, that's the sort of thing. Surely, if you're actually engaged in court facing the Bank of England, you may even find out some basic facts about it.
Yeah.
You may even find out who its shareholders are. So can I press you on what the case was about?
You can. Well, you can, although it's actually embarrassing in a way. There's an embarrassing aspect, but it led to a lot of seasoned, really good information. Just to answer that thing that you mentioned about shareholders, just immediately after the case, And although it didn't go well for us, it didn't actually knacker my life, although I had to take myself kind of out of the economic system for the next 5 years, so about 2006. I actually used to call the Bank of England up to ask if they would give me the names of their shareholders. I don't know if you've ever done this. And it was, oh, I stopped after a while. I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere. But, the, you know, one of the responses at first was, well, we don't give that information out. And my next question was, so there are shareholders of the Bank of England. Well, we don't give that information out either. And I said, well, you already have, really, but never mind. And I tried three or four times. And of course, if you ask people about the Bank of England, they'll generally point you to some government statement. I think it's 1948 saying, no, the bank is a wholly owned thing of the government. This is complete horseshit, of course. But, you know, they're allowed to write and say whatever they want. The case basically was, how can I describe it? It functioned as a scheme, which they said, it gets too complicated for me to get. This is why I don't really want to go into it. The aim of it was to get people out of debt. And to use the financial firepower that he had available by trading this paper for these select clients to take the colossal profits that you make. And they're absolutely ridiculous, okay, with no risk, which sounds stupid, but it's to do with a primary function, a fault in the design of the central banking system that they have to sort of shore up. And to take that money earning power and put it in the hands of the English. He was very patriotic. And he wanted the restoration of the nation, which I've wanted ever since then. And since I've sort of fully became aware that as a group, we're being preyed upon by this fiscal parasite. And that was the gist of it. And the case basically was, this cannot be done. And the thing was that they were saying this, but it was actually happening and we were doing it. So they concocted a whole series of other charges up to disturb the organization, which they did. And in the end, I don't really know if ultimately whether it was really true or not, Tony, because this chap, I worked out later, this is my view today, and I've held to this ever since, he was using me as bait to cause this court case. The whole aim of it was not for us to fulfill the goal as I thought it was, but it was to create a project that drew their attention and firepower so that they would drag him into court. This is what he wanted. He wanted them to take him to court. And when the court case was on, he never turned up over the 3 days. So I called him at the end of each day and said, where are you? He said, I can't be bothered to come in. This, of course, blew my mind as I'm in fear of the court system at this time. But he had literally couldn't care less about it. And he said the charges later on when I saw him at Liverpool Street Station about a week later, I said, why all that? And he said, the charges are not heavy enough. He said, they have intentionally put in a lower level of charge. He had information that he wants to produce as evidence to blow the government to bits. This is what he had at the time. This is what he told me. He said, they won't allow me to present that as defense evidence on this charge. They know that I've got the information. That's why they're actually, it was more like a disturbance case. They were seeking to disturb him and what he was up to. So they were aware of certain things. And it gets very, I mean, it's comedic in a way as well. I mean, there's, you've heard about these nuclear bunkers that were built around London after World War II, you know, for the Cold War and all that kind of stuff. Well, he had one out in a farmer out in Essex Field, which is where he was originally from, had one. And he had a lot of fiscal resources down there. He had some crazy ideas in a way. I mean, you're probably aware that the mafia, I don't know if they still do, but the mafia in London, they've got tunnels stuffed with cash all over the place. Or they used to have, I guess, maybe they're having a problem with Bitcoin. But yeah. It's too labyrinthine a tale to cover in 15 minutes.
Okay, well, that's fine. What's the take home for listeners? You know, what do you learn from all this? How can you adjust your life to cope with the fact that the financial system is so fraudulent?
It's a very good question, and it's something I've been struggling with for a long time, because if you look in history, which I've spent a lot of time doing ever since, you see that there are very few incidents in history where the monetary system has been overturned for long. It has been overturned and transformed for short periods of time. And in nearly all cases, the results, certainly for the population, are spectacularly positive. They're incredibly positive. And so the individuals that have ever done that are demonized. And the ones that are most on a national or a governmental level that have been demonized the most, The one within recent living memory is Gaddafi in Libya, who was doing exactly that. He took the resources of Libya and made them available in great deal to the actual Libyan people. They were living great. You got married, you got $50,000. You didn't pay interest on the mortgage on your house. You put the pipeline in. They were growing more food. Education was free. If you studied overseas, they'd pay also. It was just as you and I think most people would imagine a truly cooperative nation working. And I'm not saying it was perfect, but it's way, way better than anybody else. And what happened to him? He was dealt with in the most savage of fashion. And of course, the first thing that happened when the United Nations or whoever it was that Hillary Clinton sent down there did was to go into the Treasury buildings and seize all the documents, which were basically the debts that the West owed Libya for their oil, so to make sure that they couldn't cash them in. That's what, you know, in nearly all cases, all the wars are bankers' wars.
So has anybody ever done something similar in Britain or tried?
In Britain, you've had a lot of studies of it. We've had, in terms of practical things on the ground, there are some very interesting cases, I think, with the Birmingham button makers. There's a book about Birmingham button makers. I think it's the 1700s. I've probably got my dates wrong, but there was a shortage of coinage. And in Birmingham, they made buttons for coats. And because there was a shortage of small change, they developed all their own local area currencies using buttons, which were very effective. Until the bank got sniff of this and shut it down. And this is what happens every single time. As soon as the people actually organize a community beneficial monetary system, it gets hammered by the parasite class. And
Walker has talked about this thing called the Bradbury pound in Britain. He's also had the greenback, which was suggested by JFK.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Justin Walker is spot on. The Bradbury pound, completely familiar with that. And I don't know I suppose your listeners may be, but effectively it was a pound that they had to introduce mid-World War One because they were running out of the circulating medium. And so they issued it debt-free, interest-free into circulation, something that is, of course, an abomination to central bankers these days. But they had to do it. And it re-stimulated the economy to a point that they could then reintroduce their interest-bearing debt money. And it's not difficult, Tony, for them to do these things because you went to school and they never taught you about central banking, did they? And everybody else goes to school right now to this very day and they don't know dick shit about it. There's a reason for that. It's actually fundamentally very simple. And they've dressed it up with all this economic blather and nonsense to make it boring. It's its greatest power is to put people to sleep. If you try to talk to people about central banking, they fall asleep within inside 30 seconds. It's a great cure for insomnia. It really is. And I don't blame them, because if you talk to people about money, the first thing emotionally that will come up for 99.99% of people is, I haven't got enough. I have to pay the bills. Let's not talk about that because it's the bane of my life. Of course, it's designed to be the bane of everybody's life. It's meant to keep you under pressure so that you are more easily controlled. It's designed subtly in that way, and that's exactly what it does.
Well, something strange has happened where money at some points has been serving humanity. Certainly, you know, in times of high wages and that sort of thing back in the 1950s, 60s, even into the 70s. But now it just seems to be the opposite, that it's enslaving humanity. Yep. The one aspect of what you're saying is quite obvious, is that it doesn't seem to be any kind of financial sovereignty. In other words, that it's international interests that are running Britain's finance. Even though we've got a pound, the pound doesn't really mean anything, because that gives us an idea that our currency is somehow sovereign. It's not. Who is really in charge then?
The network of central banks is the force and the characters behind that. Of course, you know, in public, it's the Bank of International Settlements at Basel, BASLE. But also you could pronounce it Baal, as in their god, BAAL, because I don't think anything's without a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that they like their little names and tricks. It's that coterie of these organizations and power groups, which are long-standing, centuries standing. The advent of the Bank of England is a very interesting tale, because it occurred under circumstances not wholly dissimilar from the advent of the Federal Reserve. So when the Federal Reserve got put through in just before Christmas, 1913, I think it is, there were no representatives on the floor. They'd all gone home for the Christmas break. There's hardly anybody there. And they've been banging on about having a flexible money supply, which you don't need. It's all horseshit. And it got passed because no one was there to oppose it. They'd all gone home for Christmas pud. England, 1694, the same vote is taking place, but this time in August. No one there. Why? Because all the parliamentarians were farmers. So they were all out on the fields bringing the crops in. It was the time of harvest and no one was there. And a similar device. So they do it 1694 and they rerun it again in 1913, which is what, 230 years later or some 220 years later. It's not that long, really. And so the same, they use the same tactics over and over. And as many people may know, the bank had only been going about 4 years. They'd already overdone 3 million quid that didn't exist because that's what they do. And central banking is a key part of the Communist Manifesto, right? Central banking and a progressive income tax. So I've pointed out to people for most of my life, you live under communism. They go, I don't.
Well, yeah, but it's fascism, really, isn't it? Because if you've got private owners of these central banks, I mean, just like the Reichsbank in Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, the communists, it's just as much private as it is state run. It's a fact. I mean, ideally, if you really are a communist, fascist, evil person, it's both, you know, so the state is.
It is. That's what I was just about. Interest. It's both. It's absolutely both. I mean, communism was bought and paid for by capitalism. You know, Marx sat on his brains, didn't they, in the British Lending Library for 20 years, courtesy of Lord Rothschild's pay ticket. They built it. So the city of London, which has got nothing to do with London, is an international hodgepodge of, you know, whatever. And they paid for communism because the ultimate client in capitalism is a communist country because you've got everybody enchained in income tax. So you enter the whole nation. And this is how they've caused all the wars. They basically say, oh, well, if you balk on this, we'll put pressure on these other countries around you and they'll be marching down your streets and kicking your head in.
So how do these digital things like Bitcoin and the proposed central bank digital currencies, how do they fit into all this?
Well, if you remove one of the conversations I used to have with Ray very early on, this is back in 95, 96. You may remember that we'd just gone through a flurry of the arrival of the credit card. Actually, it'd been running through the 80s, hadn't it? Because it was all part of the me, I can buy whatever I like type thing. And then debit cards came along. And we were talking about all these cards, and what is true then will still be true now. They don't like cash. They don't like it. Now, cash at the time accounted for something like 2% of the entire money supposedly on the books in England or the UK, about 2%. It might be the same. I think it's a bit lower now. It's a very small percentage of the overall amount of digital doodads flying around the ether. Why do they want to get rid of even that? Because then they have complete control. Total control. Cash fosters all sorts of little groups that can meet at the pub and do things. They can do things without them knowing what you've done. And of course, as their power has increased, their paranoia about not having total power has also increased. So I think this is a key part of it. The digital currencies won't solve anything at all because it's nothing to do, in my view, with the form of the money that we use. It's always to do with governance. Who's doing the governing? Under what law, under what acts from the law will they fall if they get it wrong? There is no justice for us because these people have taken themselves outside of the law by buying it. So, you know, what's his name? Old Amschel Rothschild said, I don't care who makes a country's laws. Give me control of the money and I'm cool. And that's because once they've got control of the money, they buy the law. It's the first thing they buy is the courts. You're done. You're done.
You mentioned Karl Marx being financed by the Rothschilds. Is there really any evidence for that?
Yeah, of course. Well, I don't know. I couldn't produce any at my bottom right now. But who paid him? You know, who paid him? It's a long time to sit on your backside coming up with tripe. Well, I mean, it's total nonsense.
It's not at all nonsense, Marx. That's a very naive thing to say. I mean,
no, it's not. It's a very informed thing to say. I'm not naive at all.
Das Kapital is probably one of the best explanations of the slow control of history by the capitalists and also, of course, the mistreatment and misuse of working class, of agricultural workers, of industrial workers.
But he was working for them. Like I said, it's two sides of the same coin. It's irrelevant. I'm not for capitalism either. They're all a nonsense. They paid for him because getting countries enslaved to Bolshevik communism really works for them. Didn't work for anybody else. And of course, this is a religious thing, if you want to go into that. It's absolutely to do with a spiritual religious war. There's a certain tribe noted for their predominant control of the financial industry. It's not all the people from that tribe, but it's certainly the case. And they've used it as the major weapon to absolutely knacker Western Christian nations. And it's been very, very effective. Because yeah, they've appealed to the greed of the aristocracy.
In the 1990s, I was familiar with some people in London, such as the Christian Council for Monetary Justice. There were several other
groups.
And a guy called Mohammed Rafiq. There was a whole sort of group of people who were publishing this. I don't know, it sounds a bit similar to your guys' newsletter, maybe a bit more mainstream. But were completely committed to this idea, which actually links up in a way with Islam now, because they have quite strict rules about money, which we don't in the West.
Islamic laws on money are way better than what we've got. Yeah, because they don't allow the charging of riba, interest. It's not charged. So there is a way to design a banking system that absolutely would work for all of us, but we're not allowed to have it because it wouldn't work predominantly to the advantage of the privileged few. So they ensure that we can't get it by controlling the political class, the papers, all the usual stuff that you're aware of. So that the idea, I mean, this conversation we're having right now is as rare as hen's teeth. People don't have this conversation. You do. I do. But the thing that people like us have to remind ourselves is the guy in the pub doesn't even know that this topic exists. He doesn't know that you can even question the type of money that you could use. We are burdened with a certain type. Now, in Islamic banking, they charge a service fee. There's ways that you could we could take the banking system as it sits right now, and we could make one or two tweaks which would relieve the pressure massively, not overnight, but gradually and inexorably and relentlessly improve things. And one is the removal of interest on loans, and you replace it with a service charge. I think that's what they do in Islamic banking. So you want to borrow £1,000, they go, it's £100 to arrange that loan. So the bankers get £100, you get £1,000, you pay £1,100 back. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And there's also ways to structure.
I mean, we
no, it's not. It's not interest at all.
Laws against usury, which is, you know, the British version, up until the time of Henry VIII, the mid-1500s, and the Reformation. So when Protestantism came in, it all usury started quietly to become the norm.
Yes, of course, because you have to look at who's behind Protestantism at the root. It goes back to the black nobility of Venice are behind it. And, of course, they were usurers. And they wanted it back in. So they were a bit cross with the Pope over certain things that had happened in, I don't know, with the League of Cambrai in 1400 and odd or something like that. So you've got the whole of Europe as Catholic nations, and they destroyed it. And this is why, of course, in London, you've got things like Lombardy Street and stuff like that. The Venetians came over and brought their system into London and brought usury with them in a big way. They also invaded Henry VIII's court, which is probably, got no evidence on this, Tony, but he had a lot of trouble producing sons. There were a lot of doctors and spies lurking around in his court, and I think they were buggering about with him a lot. That's what I think. It's just a guess. Possibly. I can't prove it.
I mean, you know, you could also look upon it as this sort of, at the time, there was a massive like pogrom against Catholics. We even had this sort of thing going on in the English Civil War too. The Scots got involved in a big way with the Jacobites. And so you've got possibly maybe the whole reason for, you know, a bit like Gaddafi, the reason for the dissolution of the monasteries and the getting rid of that those church institutions in the dissolution of the monasteries was, number one, because the crown and the establishment owed a lot of money to the monasteries, but secondly also because they just wanted to be able to start charging interest.
I think those are parts of it. I think the key thing with regard to the monasteries is to do with Henry VIII's gradual loss of power. When he decided to go against the Pope, he needed allies from his own court. Even he couldn't have done that. It was a big thing about being excommunicated from the church, no matter what people might want to think about it today. At the time, it was a big deal to everybody. So he was looking for allies, and they basically made a deal with him. whoever they were. I can't give you the names, but I know, I think I've read this in some of Belloc's accounts of this period and others, maybe Chesterton and things like this. What happened was they said, look, we will stand with you. We will break from Rome, but we want a kickback. So he had to provide it. And they obviously asset stripped all the monasteries because that's where the power was. So, and he thought he'd be able to hang on to all his power, and he couldn't. And that was the beginning of laying in the roots of bringing about democracy, which is a disease as well. It's just slow burn communism, as far as I'm concerned.
No, it isn't. No, hang on a minute.
Well, I don't, okay, that's fine. We just disagree, but that's okay. That's okay to disagree, but I'm telling you what I think, Tony. Yeah, but hang on.
Democracy is a word which means people rule. And it doesn't matter what the system is. The principle is important.
I agree. If only you could show me a democratic state that actually works where the people rule, but they never do that. That's why I said it's slow burn communism. What have we got now? We just morph into it. So it's a sense, or you can call it slow burn fascism or fascio communism. It doesn't really matter. It's where the power morphs and moves into ever fewer hands. That's what happens. Yeah.
I mean,
so we can say platitudes like, oh, yeah, the people have got a democracy, but they haven't. Well, they have a governing class that treats them like shit.
Democracy is a principle, as far as I can see. And that's what words mean. The system, obviously, is being undermined massively. But the principle, it still stands that the government there should be there to serve the people. Look, you've been mentioning several bits and bobs to do with books and things. Could you start off maybe by giving us a few books for the hardcore, and then some films for people who haven't got so much time on their hands to get to look into all this?
Gosh, I don't do films really, Tony. I'm hard pressed to think of any. I suppose that you'd mean YouTube videos and the like and stuff like that.
Well, there are some documentaries. I mean, we could start with Bill Still's work. I mean, he's done very good ones. I mean, The Money Masters is a really good introduction to all of this. And I think it's called The Secret of Oz, isn't it? Another one of his.
Yeah, there's some good stuff there. I mean, books-wise, if you wanted something, look, it's out of date, but it's fantastically clear, and I loved this. This is by Belloc from about 100 years ago, Hilaire Belloc. He wrote a book called Economics for Helen. Helen is an imagined girl of 14 years of age, of average intelligence, but going back 100 years, average intelligence is pretty high, right? Now, it's only about 110 pages, and some of the mechanisms that he talks about, of course, are antiquated and no longer work in terms of check clearance and stuff like this. But as a primer for understanding the problem with usury, with the charging of interest, which, of course, the Roman Catholic Church was wholly against, as it should have been, because it understood the dangers of it, until Calvin came along and said, oh, a little bit of interest is okay. No, none of it is okay. It's a very good primer. So I know it seems old, and maybe it's written in an antiquated style, but I actually think it's written in a very clear style. They wrote better back then because it's just better written stuff, in my view. So there's that. Currently, what I'm reading with regards to finance, there's an economist still alive called Michael Hudson from the States. He's quite brilliant. And I got a book from him the other day called, and you might be interested in this from the religious aspect, or at least the history of Christianity, or the history of the people of the Middle East. It's called And Forgive Them Their Debts. Not forgive them their sins, forgive them their debts. And it's to do with debt forgiveness all the way through to about 1000 BC. Hammurabi, Babylonia, places like that, and the spectacular results that would take place. Now, so what I'm going to say is very, very simplistic, and everybody's going to go, that can't be done. It could be, like anything else could be, but we've got a lot of forces opposing it. What he shows, you just get this from the introduction, read the first sort of 10 or 15 pages. The book's huge, and it's got a lot of information in for people that really want to drill down. But the gist of it is, when a new king, for example, was about to be crowned, they would forgive all the agrarian debts to start off with, and they would forgive subsequent debts as well. And, of course, the patrician class, the creditor class, never liked this. Of course not. They didn't like it. But what it would do for the king is it would restore the entire nation. Everybody was actually ultimately better off. It's just that the patrician class would go through a period of pain where they couldn't pull their debts in as fast.
Well, might also provide a motive to kill the king off.
Well, it's a very good point, because that's exactly what it did. In fact, Julius Caesar, was killed probably in great part for that. He was only in charge of Rome for about 3 or 4 years. And when he came in, there were about 150,000 people sleeping like dossers on the streets. It was a complete shithole. And he'd had enough. So he began this program of the forgiveness of debts. And it was a patrician class that organized to have him murdered. They wanted their power back. So this split always takes place, seems to take place as a civilization matures and power and wealth accrues to few hands. They are more skilled at getting it than the others, just like someone's more skilled, say, at football. But it's very, very dangerous. Because they then separate themselves off from the great mass of people, view us as pigs, and treat us accordingly. And I think historically a lot of that has taken place. It's unfortunate, but it seems to be in human nature that this is what happens, and which is why civilizations start off, grow, rise, and then subsequently fall because of internal fighting.
But I mean, it's there in human nature. It's just a question of people's own inclination as to which part of their nature they want to emphasize. And another book which I came across probably around about the turn of the century, around about 2000, was something called The Grip of Death, a study.
I've got that on my shelf. I'm just looking at it. Yeah, Michael Robotham.
Mike Robotham, a study of modern money, debt, slavery, and destructive economics, which is fairly. I mean, he writes really for people who are aware that something's wrong, but want to get into the detail of it.
It's a very, very good book. And I met him once. I used to go to meetings at Quaker House, friend's house in Euston Road, the big one down there, before they wrecked it.
Involved with this Christian Council for Monetary Justice.
Yes, I was looking at all those things at the time. I used to meet up with a group there called the Round Table, headed up by the Reverend Peter Challen, lovely chap. I don't know if he's still with us. He was seasoned back then.
Yeah, I remember him.
Yeah, lovely guy, white hair, lovely guy, and lots of other guys. A guy called Rodney Shakespeare. I got his book, Binary Economics, which is all to do with, now you get into more technical things. And these were really, they were lovely people. They're very intelligent, obviously very well educated, in a strata above me, but wonderfully gracious and kind. And we had some wonderful conversations down there about these things.
Well, one of the people down there is Sabine McNeil. I don't want to name drop, but she was involved in this Hampstead court case and then got shipped off to Germany, stuck in jail, etc. Yeah. The Hampstead child abuse, alleged child abuse case as well. So bit by bit.
I know Sabine, Tony. Yeah, just to wind it all the way back to the beginning of the conversation. You know, I mentioned I was working at ASLIB in the early 90s, this Association of Librarians. Well, Sabine was in the same space. She used to come in regularly back then. So that's 30 years back. So if she saw me, she might still recognize me. I don't know what's happened. I heard about the Hampstead thing, but I didn't follow it closely. I don't know if she's run away or got away or what's happened to her. Were you saying she's incarcerated or something? I don't know.
Yeah, she's over in Germany now. She was imprisoned. For talking about a child abuse case, which was all fake and false. Well, I think she was set up, I think, in all that situation. But anyway, she was spun out of the country. She's fine. And she's now back in, out of London. That's the main thing, I suppose. And that group, there's all sorts of interesting people in that group. But look, as a final question, this is a Christian Council for Monetary Justice, if people want to look them up. A final question has got to be about war, really, because we're seeing the wobbles with the US economy this week. Our own economy, it seems to be in slow strangulation. And yet the answer to these things, as in the 1930s, seems to be war that these people are preparing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's more than just the 90s. It's all the time. I mean, since the Bank of England was formed in 1694, I think there's only ever been 5 years between then and now where British military power has not been employed somewhere in the world killing someone. 5 years. Prior to that, we were fine. So what happened is this rampant, aggressive, acquisitive, parasitical force used us to create a thing called the British Empire, which I maintain didn't exist. What did exist was the empire of the City of London, using British manpower and brains, which we did some fantastic stuff, but I don't believe in colonialism. As you can see, it's a bit of a problem long term. But I guess maybe at the time the people thought, well, if we don't do it, the Belgians will do it or someone else. And maybe they were right. I wasn't living at those times. But they always use war, Tony, because it's a great way to clear the books. You destroy the infrastructure, you destroy your own indebtedness, you clear the system, and then people have to come back to you to borrow money to rebuild it all again. It's completely insane. But from their point of view, it's not, because they just want to control us. That's all it's about, permanent control. you know, I've had people say, well, they make all this money. I said, well, why, what do they want their money for? You know, they've already got as many helicopters as they want. It's to make sure that you don't get the money. Not only must they win, you must lose so that you are supine before them. And this is part of their character, if you want to call it character, that's it. And you mentioned, you asked about books. There's one here on my shelf, which is possibly the Rolls Royce of books on monetary systems, which I really rate. I spoke to the author a few times. He's now passed, a gentleman called Stephen Zarlenga. He wrote a book called The Lost Science of Money. It's probably very expensive now, but I've got a copy here. It's the full history from Babylon right through. If you really want to know it at that level, and I do and did and do now, that's an absolutely fantastic book for getting stuck into it. Another one worth mentioning is by the central banker. This is fantastically accessible, actually, to everybody. I've just read it the other week for about the third time. Stephen Mitford Goodson was a central banker in South Africa. He was probably done away with by the other side about four, I think it's about 2018 he died. He was in hospital, and it's a great pity. Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, I think, interviewed him once or twice. Anyway, he wrote a book. I can't remember the title of it right now. I ought to, but it's about central banking. And it's 200 pages, and I would recommend it above probably all others because it's so accessible, and it will show you this pattern of warfare. It will show you why they destroyed the Tsar in Russia in the mid-1800s, why they wanted to do that. It will show you, you will disagree with what I'm about to say, why they organized to wage war on Germany. Germany's economic system makes their system look like a joke. You can't have a country like Germany transforming its economic situation in 3 years flat and putting practically everybody back to work and doing so by cutting the international bankers out. And Churchill said that. You may know of the quote. He said, Germany's great crime was to cut international finance out of its slice of the profits, as if they've got a right to them. That's a key component of why that war took place. The economic system they had in Germany is magnificent. Absolutely amazing.
I said a final question, but then there is also a brilliant book, a kind of small hardback, actually, by Paul Hamlin, which is called The Story of Money.
Right.
The system, and in there, it'd be interesting to see what you make of this. They say that the big competition back at sort of 2000 BC was between money systems back in the ancient world, where the Egyptians had a system of credit, where everybody in Egypt had a little inventory in a kind of central bank system. And the Jews had actual gold and coins, which were worth something. And so I wonder whether some of this is sort of playing out today.
Well, I think you're right. You know, I've looked at gold, and I went through a period when I was studying all the von Mises stuff, the Austrian school, and it's very appealing. And I'm not saying it's without merit. I mean, I sound like a cocky booger. I'm not a high class economist at that level. But when I contacted Stephen Zarlenga, the author I just mentioned to you, I had about three or four phone calls with him, and he immediately said, you're mistaken about gold. It's not the solution. And I didn't like the idea at the time. I have to tell you, emotionally, I didn't like it. I was a bit cross about this. But we carried on talking. And what he said, and Aristotle is correct. Aristotle's correct. Money is a creature of law. It really is. And law is the agreement come from God that we absolutely agree upon. Now, of course, in the Bible, it talks about honest weights and measures. Because it's interesting, Tony, I'm looking at your site the other day about the religious things that you've got on there, or the Christian things. And my inquiry into banking, which really took off massively under my own steam after this court case, just led me straight through to scripture, where all the answers can be found, and quite a lot more besides, in my view, things that have dwarfed my understanding really of money, because there is this spiritual war taking place. We are fighting spiritual wickedness in high places, and one of the great weapons that they have used is the wielding of money and debt. And going back to Hudson's book, Forgive Them Their Debts, one of the things he suggests, if you look at Christ's first public act, and this is the bit this is where I get more excited about Christ's life than anything else, is that he goes down to the temple and whips the money changers. And the next thing he does is they drag him into a temple, and he has to give a speech or a reading in the synagogue. And he reads something from Isaiah. I can't quote you chapter and verse right now. But the implication that Hudson makes about this speech, because this is the second thing he did, is that he's effectively addressing the audience and saying, we've got to forgive debts. It's not forgiving sin. It's forgiving debts. And they are so cross, they nearly throw him off a cliff. I don't know if you remember that. You probably do better than I do. These are the first two things that happen once he's going out of the door. Now, I'm extremely arrested by stuff like that. I don't believe in this, what I would call wishy-washy version of so-called Christianity. I don't believe it's that at all. I think we've been led to believe that there's this sort of some dreamy, dippy-hippie Jesus who goes around loving everyone. It's complete garbage as far as I'm concerned. I don't see that in the book at all.
Well, he does say love your enemies, doesn't he? Which is a fairly revolutionary thing to say. But anyway, look, what about your own website, or if people can follow you on social media, Paul?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Tony. Yeah, I do a radio show every Thursday evening, 8 p.m. to usually now about 11 p.m. UK time, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Thursdays. You can tune into it in multiple ways, and you'll find all the tune-in methods at paulenglishlive.com. That's my website. It's just a web page, really, with all the links on it. The main space is Rumble. It's a radio show. I don't use a video feed, but Rumble gets quite lively. We have 50 or 60 people in there. Lots of good texts and chats and comments as we go through. I've got an interesting chap on this week who's fighting the being very effective at getting judges to run out of courts, something that I'm quite interested in. So that's coming up this Thursday. And also I appear on a thing called Radio Soapbox. So does your show, Tony, as you well know, which is a little nascent developing US radio station, but with a UK, or intending to have a UK centric schedule. So we're seeking to work as a team to pull in good UK hosts, good shows. They don't have to agree with one another. In fact, it's probably best that they don't, you know, to create that milieu of conversation that's hopefully presented well, reported well, and done with a good human touch, and to create a bonding point for us in these what are ever increasing and challenging times. You know,
they certainly are, especially with the week of Tommy Robinson and Islamophobia. One does wonder whether really at the root of this is the hatred that the super rich have for these people that refuse to charge interest.
I think that's a bit of a long stretch. They might have that. What I actually think is they're just playing us off against. There are all sorts of things that need to be tidied up. It's a big discussion. There's many things that need to be tidied up with regards to who lives where and under what circumstances. But the main problem I see is that the reason why we're in bad times, and I'm going to come back to scripture, it's really quite simple. If we obey the law and move toward it, we receive the blessings. If we disobey the law and move away from it, we get cursed. We're being cursed. And there's a reason people have moved away from the law. And it's not surprising, because it's not taught anymore. It's been replaced with this imaginary piffle like communism and capitalism and all these isms. They're all isms and they're all guff. Because you don't need to, as the book says, you do not need to add nor take away anything from the law. Mm. It's completely understandable by our people. And we were, and we'll get back to being strong when we move back in that direction. It won't happen overnight. I accept that maybe it will. Maybe there'll be a miracle.
We're bringing up a generation of young people that don't even know who Moses was. So it's not going to go well. Anyway, look, Paul English, thanks ever so much for joining us.
That's great, Tony. Thank you.